And welcome to Radio Book Club on Big Cabbage Radio 89.5. I'm Judy Getty, and I'll be hosting the show today as we discuss Christmas Pudding and Pigeon Pie by Nancy Mitford. And I was just reminded that this is our last live studio broadcast from our current location, that Radio Free Palmer will be moving to our new location, which is in the building next to Fireside Books. So for people who are out and about in Palmer, it's always nice to be able to see what's on the street and stop in and see what we're doing here at the radio station. So my guests today are Melissa Benke and Dylan Getty King. Welcome.
Hello. Hi there. Welcome. Glad to be here.
Thanks. Thanks for coming. So it's the holiday season, and I wanted to read a book set in at Christmas time. And so I did pick Christmas Pudding and Pigeon Pie by Nancy Mitford, which are older books, but I pulled up a review that was done by Rachel Cook in The Guardian, and this is pretty recently. And she said, Mitford's sister, Jessica, recalled that during the writing of Christmas Pudding, a comedy of errors set in the Shires over the course of a few days in December, Nancy spent months giggling helplessly by the drawing room fire, her curiously triangular green eyes flashing with amusement while her thin pen flew along the lines of a child's exercise book. Yet just months before, she had tried, albeit half-heartedly, to kill herself. She switched on the gas fire in her room without lighting it. Her convoluted pseudo-engagement to Hamish Erskine, a gay Scottish aristocrat, had finally hit the buffers, and she was all misery. Erskine had his faults, but he was also, in Nancy's eyes, a scream. Now she had no one to tell the funny things that happened to one. Completing Christmas Pudding, a book eagerly awaited by her publisher, felt like an impossible task. How to write a comic novel when you are suddenly prone to crying on buses. So before we get started, I want to remind our listeners that you may call in during the live broadcast at noon on December 31st and share your thoughts with us. The number is 745-8900. If you happen not to have read the book, maybe you just want to share with us a favorite Christmas book or story that you have read. So any comments on once you see the background about when Nancy Mitford wrote the book and under the conditions that, you know, she was writing in?
She had such an interesting family, interesting background. The prologue itself of this book, written by Jane Smiley, is incredibly interesting.
Yes, it gives you some background, which really does help. And then when I found this review, I didn't realize, maybe it was in the foreword, I don't recall it, that she had just attempted a suicide.
I don't think that was in the prologue. I don't remember that.
Okay.
That surprised me.
So, but again, she is hilariously funny, and we're going to talk about some of those, you know, funny moments in the book. But that at the same time, she's kind of grieving over this lost love, she's writing this book and laughing. Mm-hmm. And I think Jane Smiley does talk about how she would write in children's exercise books.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, for her sister to make that same observation that her pen was flying along the lines of a child's exercise book, and then she's laughing to herself.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. That kind of sets the tone, because the book is filled with paradoxes. You know, that she's grieving and yet sort of deals with it with comedy, because you see that throughout the book.
And, you know, when you say that, and I've read a lot of different types of Christmas stories, so we can, you know, talk about that in general, too, but you would think that they're supposed to be happy and joyous, and this is a funny book, but there's times when you think these are some desperate people in some desperate situations at the same time. Mm-hmm. So, yes, the paradoxes are there.
And, I mean, going off the paradox of Mitford, Nancy Mitford, the author, being suicidal and then writing this silly kind of book, is that I think that I got the impression that she was very much more like an observer of the paradoxes of the world, and so would write them into her stories just to be funny, you know. So there she is, suicidal and writing this comedic Christmas story, you know. It's kind of funny.
And she uses a lot of her own You get that, too, when you read other reviews or the prologue of the book, that she uses a lot of her own life and her family's stories and
right.
things. Yes. So I think, you know, when... when Rachel Cook says that she's quoting, she says that Mitford had no one to tell the funny things that happened to one, that she used to tell them to her, you know, this fiancé. But now she's going to write them all down. So it's kind of our benefit. So I think the best way to talk about Christmas pudding is to talk about the characters. The second line of the book, after all, is 16 characters in search of an author. So, Melissa, do you want to talk about who's your favorite?
Oh, my favorite is definitely Amabel Fortescue.
Well, they always have wonderful names, too, don't they, in British comedies?
They
yes.
Yeah. Amabel is intelligent, she's cultured, a thoroughly nice woman. But she has an interesting background. She was alone and penniless at 18 because her father died, so she became a prostitute. She became wealthy. And then retired from that profession, married a respectable member of parliament who died, and then I think she had several marriages. Amabel is, again, that paradox, the contradiction between, in some ways, seemed shallow as a character, as a person, not a character. But has all these different layers. She's so astute. She's a good friend. She's a snob.
She'll tell it like it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, she did.
Yeah.
So do you think she came from humble beginnings?
Amabel, that wasn't real clear, I don't think.
Because I guess one of the funny things I want to point out about the character is, of course, Amabel takes the country home. So this is where the setting for Christmas is going to kind of revolve around. And, you know, so her friends are all giving her a bad time about going to the country because people from London, of course, just thought the country was boring and who could possibly spend time there and enjoy it.
Right.
But there's one situation where Amabel then has gone out walking because apparently that's what country folks do. And so she's been out walking and she's telling the story about only yesterday I came across the bodies of two dear little rabbits, which must have been killed by some lynch maniac. So, you know, so she's got this in her head that there's just, it's terrifying to think that there are such men wandering about. I brought the poor mites home and gave them decent burial in the garden. And so another one of the characters, Sally Monteith, says the lynch maniac must have been delighted when he came back for his dinner. Because Sally had spent time in the country, and she knew that these were people who had, you know, set some trappings out to catch rabbits to eat them. And Walter remarked, that's Sally's husband, that the amount of sadism among the lower classes was truly terrible. So one of the things that, and we can talk more about this, too, as we talk about what happens in the book, but Mitford does point out the differences between the classes.
Yes.
And the rich and the poor. And I just think this is such a good example of that, you know, city and country, what we were talking about, those paradoxes, so that how differently you could see this. So the lynch maniac got the rabbits.
Right. And I like how Mitford points those things out almost always with humor.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely. Another... Dylan, you said that she tells it like it is. Mm-hmm. So another kind of plot line in the story with Amabel is that she has this old love, Michael, and do you say Lewis? I'd say Michael Lewis, I think his name is. Okay. And so he's going to come back, and he's been gone 3 years. Amabel rejected him 3 years ago. And so all this time that he's been gone, he's just been, you know, mourning, you know, his love for Amabel, and he wants to reignite that passion, and he's going to propose to her, which he does. And so she says to him, no, Michael, I don't love you. I never have loved you, and I never shall love you, and nothing that you can say or do will ever make me marry you. And I beg you, from the bottom of my heart, if we are to remain friends, then you won't bring up the subject anymore.
I love it.
Yeah.
Pretty straightforward.
Could he doubt her position? You would think not, yes. So he even agrees, very well, I won't speak of it again. So, And then I think the other example, Dylan, again, about him being, or about her, Amabel being forthright, is when the characters Paul and Philadelphia come to talk to her about their romance.
Yes.
So do you want to comment on that? Or?
I mean, she's just not afraid to say, you two are being quite silly. You've known each other 3 weeks. You're not possibly in love. Philadelphia, you're much better suited for Michael, who's a diplomat and is well up in society, whereas Paul is this fumbling writer in London who can't stand to get a real job. And so Amabel just kind of sets him straight and tells him what to do, and they have to follow her advice, I guess.
Well, they don't want to. I mean, they rejected it first.
That's true. Yeah. But then they try.
So since we're talking about Amabel, then one of the other characters that's introduced is Major Stanworthy. And so do either of you want to comment on what kind of character he is?
No.
There are so many characters in this book.
Yes, there are.
It is hard to keep them straight.
But I got the impression, so they invite him to dinner, and he's a local country person. And so he talks about his sheep.
Oh, yes.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I think he kind of, with this crowd of people coming from London that are Amabel's friends, I'm not sure of the proper term, but they're pretty well off in London, and then they come to the country to experience this country house, and then a countryman does join them for dinner, and they're all just so shocked, like, what do you mean? You know, people garden all day? What's this foot and mouth disease killing everything? You know, what is that about? He kind of, I think, brings him back to earth and is like, this is what's going on. Yeah.
Very literally. Mm-hmm. I mean, because he's a local farmer.
Yeah.
So, yes. And so he is a juxtaposition to the other characters because he's not sophisticated and he's just very salt of the earth kind of guy. And so at the end, it turns out that Amabel has agreed to marry him, and everybody is just appalled because now she's going to stay in the country full time. How could she possibly do that?
Yeah, that was one of the things that just made me love Amabel by the end of the story. Just that sort of turnaround.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of showed the depth of her character, really.
Mm-hmm. Because, I think at some point they tell you she's 45, but,
yeah.
You know, it's 1932, and so this is kind of, she's on the tail end of her life, and she's mm-hmm. not intending to do anything else or have another great love or make any major changes. But you're right. I mean, that's the kind of character she is. This opportunity presents itself, and it's like, okay, let's go with it. Sounds like an adventure. So, Dylan, did you have a favorite character?
Yeah, all of Melissa's points about Amabel were quite on point. I think as far as, like, characterization goes, I think Philadelphia was a good character in terms of, I guess, running the story and just being relatable. I bookmarked a point. Let's see if I can find it. Where it's describing how she's grown up and she's 18 and her mother, Lady Bobbin, has put her out into London for her coming out. And it's just describing her. She's found herself to be the girl that arrives awkwardly early. And no boys ever want to dance with her. And she is never sure, you know, what to talk about in conversation. And really, she prefers to be at home reading, I think is what it said at one point. And so I think she's very plain girl, but at the same time, she has the same wants as, you know, to find a husband and to have a boy love her. And I think that's charming, I guess.
So one of the things that's said about this time period is that in the type of book that Mitford writes, and of course, in some ways, Fitzgerald does too, The Bright Young Things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this time period when people were supposedly, you know, gay, meaning, you know, happy, and saw the world in kind of light terms and, you know, enjoyed dancing and drinking. And when they said made love to, it really just meant like flirtatiousness or, you know, kind of, you know, much less than what we might think of it as. So Philadelphia seems to be, in some ways, you know, again, she's not really a bright young thing in those terms. And to me, again, thinking that, okay, this is 1932, and even though there were more opportunities for young women, she still only saw her real choice as being kind of an old maid mm-hmm. or finding the right husband. Would you agree with that, or did you get a sense that she would have seen any other kind of path for herself?
I think she hoped for another path for herself, and I think that she felt fated to be an old maid stuck at home with her mother or to be married off to some guy she didn't love but her mother approved of. But I think she hoped for something.
Wasn't she the one who early on, there was a comment about she hoped that death wasn't as boring as life?
I think she did say that, yes.
Yeah, so I think that goes along with your point, Judy. I don't think she saw too many options, really. Mm-hmm. And she loved it when the people descended upon the country house, and she started making new friends. And that was the first time there really was excitement in her life.
And she talks about that, that everything happened in that 1 month compared to, like, the whole rest of her life when nothing had happened.
Right.
Yeah. So I just want to interject here that you are listening to Radio Big Cabbage Radio 89.5. And if you want to call in and share any of your thoughts about either what we're talking about or a Christmas book or story that you loved, call us at 745-8900. So Philadelphia ends up falling in love with Paul. And that's another character we can talk about in after this. But really, she seems better suited to Michael, who now, since Amabel has rejected, he's looking for... I know. They just... It's like, okay, I won't love you anymore, and now looks around.
Who's the next girl that walks in the...
Yeah, oh, who's okay. The next girl? Yeah. Oh, you look available. So he sets his sights on her. And because I think he had been so romantic with Amabel, you know, heartfelt... And so now he tries a very business-like approach, which, of course, for a girl of 21, that is just not the approach that's going to work at all. And so he's very matter-of-fact and kind of business-like with Philadelphia and lays it out to her. And, well, she's just not interested in that kind of proposal. So, Dylan, because you're the young person here in
sure.
the discussion, was there anything about that? Do you think her age... you know, contributed to how we're talking about her and how we see her and her choices?
I think she is very upstanding, as I would suppose is opposite to other girls her age at that time. So I think she's very smart and very thoughtful. I mean, I was laughing throughout the whole scene of Michael proposing to her and taking her through a walk through the garden. You're kind of picturing a very Pride and Prejudice-like scene. And then he says, I'm leaving town. Let's get married. You can give me your answer when I'm back on Tuesday. And then just leaves her. And she just doesn't know what to do. You know, she has to debate, you know, do I really love him? Or is this just the next nice guy that walked in the room? Or, you know. So I think she's very more, much more considerate of different things than 21-year-old girls are.
Okay. So I mentioned the other person that's a love interest for her is Paul. And so Paul Fotheringay, so again, another really fun name, kind of is the impetus for setting the plot for this book. So Paul has written a book called Crazy Capers. And so as Christmas pudding begins, as the story begins, Paul's book has just been published. It's been a huge success. He's getting really rave reviews. But unfortunately, everybody thinks it's a comedy. And he had written it as a tragedy. And so he is rather upset.
Oh, he is so devastated.
You know, and he's looking for one person who perhaps read the book and really understood that this was a tragedy. And which he finds in Philadelphia at later on. So, but anyway, so Paul Fotheringay now is looking for the next book he wants to write. And he wants to write a book about one of the Bobbins' ancestors. And Philadelphia is a Bobbin. So he writes to Philadelphia's mother in the hopes of having access to this ancestor's journals and papers. And is rejected. And so he devises this, and again, I don't know if either of you are big fans of like black and white old romantic comedy movies, but you could just see this playing out, you know, on the big screen as that kind of film.
Yeah.
So there's this, you know, secret identity then is concocted. So he becomes Paul Fisher. Okay, so he's going to go to the Bobbins' home and pretend to be the male Bobbins' tutor during the Christmas break.
Right.
Okay. And have access.
Yeah, brother Bobby.
Yes. So Bobby is Philadelphia's brother. And so he concocts this plan with Bobby, who is, you know, all game for this kind of adventure, and Amabel, who also has, you know, a foot in this game. So he now has become Paul Fisher, and so he can get access to the house and the papers. So just, you know, he was a funny character too. He was not really as a character going to make it as a tutor, right? He's not.
Not really suited to that.
No. Because what does Lady Bobbin really expect of him as the tutor?
That he's going to keep Bobby outside. She thinks that a man's place is outdoors. She's a great horsewoman. That's really all she cares about. So she wants to see him playing outdoor games and things. She's not so concerned about his education, his academic, I don't think.
Yeah, so they concoct a big story that really he's so far behind in his academics that it's going to take the entire morning just to address that.
That's right.
And so that during that time, then Bobby can just be lazing about and sleeping while Paul is going through all of the ancestors' journals and paperwork. So, but there is a funny little vignette about when he does go out riding, because of course that is one of the outdoor things that Lady Bobbin, of course, wants her son to do, was go riding. And Paul assures her that, you know, he can ride, and he's terrible at it. And so they just have to kind of get off the property so that it appears that they know what they're doing. But again, not so good at it. Just another kind of funny comment that. And I don't know if you found yourself doing this, but I'd write things down thinking, oh, I'm going to look that up because I thought it was something real, but really Mitford's just making things up.
Yep, I did that.
Okay. And just along that line, one of the words, H-O-L-S, Halls.
How are your halls?
How are your halls, yeah. And so at first I thought, what is that? And I was talking to a friend about visiting Australia, and she says they abbreviate everything and add an S to it. And so then it was like, oh, they've been doing this for a long time. So yeah. It's short for holidays, which I didn't get. Dylan seemed to have gotten that earlier than I did. But one of the things then that Mitford makes up is this, Paul is talking about.
Judy, I have to interrupt you.
Okay.
Just because it just dawns on me that isn't that a current trend now? I mean, that young people, instead of saying whatever, they say whatev, or. You know, they shorten things.
Uh-huh.
So that's been going on a long time.
It still is. Yes, my grandsons, I heard them saying, instead of saying, oh, I'm jealous of you for having that.
Jelly.
I'm jelly. Yeah.
Jelly.
Yeah. So you're right. You're absolutely right. It's still going on. New version. Okay. So anyway, Paul is referring to Buchanism, I'll say. And he says it's the name given to a religious sect founded by Mrs. Elspeth Buchan, a Scot and vastly superior prototype of Mrs. Eddy and Mrs. Besant. Now, I didn't look up if there was actual Elspeth Buchan.
I didn't either.
I'm thinking there's not.
I don't think so.
Okay. In fact, she started that fashion for the founding of religions by untitled married ladies, which has since become almost universal. You know, what kind of observation is that?
Well, I love this whole thing about Paul having this kind of strange, very secular, made-up, quote-unquote made-up, religion by Mitford, because I think it just adds to his character of being so, like, rightly divine that he just thinks he's a genius, and he's written this tragedy, but nobody understands, and now he has this strange religion of Buchanism that people just don't understand.
That's right, and there are, in the book, there are followers of it. There are large groups of people that come to the house at different times, aren't
there? Oh, that's the next book.
Oh, that's the next book.
That's
sorry.
That's okay. It's easy to get mixed up.
It's a theme.
Yes.
Okay.
Just another one of the things she likes to poke fun at,
that's
apparently.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. One of the other kind of little fun character things that Paul does is, later on, as it gets closer to Christmas, the house is getting even more filled with a variety of relatives and family friends. And so there's Captain and Lady Brenda Chadlington who have come to the home, and they have two children. And the children are named Christopher, Robin, and Wendy. So Paul takes pity on these two children being named for characters. And again, this book is so old, 1932, and yet we have Winnie the Pooh and Peter Pan references. So he calls them George and Mabel, his lips refusing to utter their real names, and they become very attached to each other. So there is a little funny story that they're out walking, and he says, tell us a story, tell us a story. And so he heard something on the radio or read something in a magazine about the rats. Mm-hmm. Do you remember the story?
I mean, I can't remember it verbatim as Paul was supposed to have said it, but he's walking through a field, and one of them is just throwing stones. And so somebody throws a stone and kills a mouse or a rat. And the other one just stops and stands there instead of scurrying away, as you would imagine. And so he looks down and later realizes that it was a blind rat, and the one they killed was leading it with a piece of hay. And they just take pity on this blind rat. So then they killed its leader.
The kids are, well, then what happened? Well, I know that's the end of the story. There's this blind rat with this piece of straw in its mouth. Just stopped. He thought the other rat had stopped for a drink of water or something.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Oh, my goodness. The other odd thing about Mabel or Wendy is it refers to her hobby, which is she likes to read the morning paper because she's keeping track of stillborn babies. That's terrible. She wrote down the number of stillborn babies every day, as announced in the birth columns of the Times. This lugubrious hobby seemed to afford her the deepest satisfaction.
And this child is how old?
Very young, I thought. Seven?
Seven.
Yeah.
Seven, yeah. And then she got so excited when there were triplets. But I couldn't tell if they were stillborn or if there was just a set of triplets born. I'm not sure.
Dark humor. Humor.
Yeah. Which is so interesting because sometimes the story as a whole comes across as just sort of light and fluffy,
mm-hmm.
you know? And yet there are these threads of darkness and just very astute observations about life. And
mm-hmm.
it is.
And maybe that's more true to form because, you know, on the way over here, I was thinking about Christmas stories and how sometimes they are so light and fluffy and, you know, everything is wonderful. And the one thing, if you read some of the reviews of Mitford's work, is that she didn't believe in the happy ending,
right.
as a quote. She did not believe in the happy ending. And so, and again, knowing her frame of mind, I guess when she's writing this, that she was grieving that love and had, you know, had suicidal thoughts, that it kind of makes sense that those threads of darkness are in the story.
Right. Oh, and going back to something you mentioned, Judy, about how she used things from her own life and put them in the stories, I think you mentioned that the character Paul, Father and Gay, his first book, he was so devastated that his first book, which he had written as a tragedy, people saw it as comic. Well, in the prologue, it mentions that Mitford was ashamed of her first novel, that it was a commercial success, but she was ashamed of it, and she didn't really say why. But I just thought that was interesting that she put that. I didn't realize on that till later. I went back.
I made a list of all of her books because I'm going to, you know, work my way through them just because they're so wonderful. But I almost wonder, because she's such a young author, I think she wrote this when she was 28. And so, you know, so her first book obviously was even, she was younger. And, you know, maybe looking back when she was in her 30s or so, she just thought there was some naivete or some youthfulness in the first book.
She almost strikes me as kind of a funnier version of a Sylvia Plath, I guess. You know, her stories are a little bit sad, I guess, but then, like, if you were to take a Sylvia Plath book and put a bunch of funny elements into it, I think it would be a Nancy Mitford novel.
Okay. Okay. So I mentioned that Mitford does not like the happy ending, and so one of the things that Paul says is kind of illustrative of her own attitude. So he's talking about, you know, getting married, and he says, oh, dear, it really is rather disillusioning. When one's friends marry for money, they are wretched. When they marry for love, it is worse. What is the proper thing to marry for? I should like to know. And so her approach to marriage is that you either marry for love or money, but you don't get both.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. There were some really good quotes about romance and love.
So I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Radio Free Palmer on 89.5 Big Cabbage Radio. This is Radio Book Club, and we're talking about Christmas pudding and pigeon pie with Dylan Getty King and Melissa Benke. Okay. If anybody wants to call in and make a comment, you can do that. Our phone number is 745-8900. Just maybe a couple other characters that we could talk about is certainly Bobby, Bobbin. Like we mentioned, he's the reason that Paul is at the house as far as pretending to be his tutor. And he is truly, I think, a bright young thing. Mm-hmm. He's hedonistic. He just wants to have fun. And, you know, he likes playing jokes. One of my favorite anecdotes about him was he's writing thank you notes to people who did not send him anything. Yeah. But he's trying to come up with wealthy people
who he
can thank for these elaborate gifts. And I would imagine with the hopes that they'll get it and go, oh, my God, we better send him something. You know, he thinks we did.
And so he's just very meddlesome for his own enjoyment, if anything.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Make trouble, yes. So Philadelphian Bobby's mother is Lady Bobbin, and she's kind of an interesting character, too. As Melissa mentioned, she's a horsewoman, and all she really likes to do is hunt. And, of course, hunting is off because of the foot and mouth disease. And so she's rather bored and doesn't have too much to do, but one of the interesting conversations that I noted in here, and they're talking about, their repartee is so funny. So Paul says, and of course, I'd love to see others hunt, but how rotten about the foot and mouth. So wretched for the poor cows, too. And she says, what cows? And he says, the ones with feet and mouths. Oh, the cows, she says vaguely. But they're all right. The government slaughters them at once, humanely, too. The terrible thing about it is the way it stops hunting. Of course, it's quite obvious to me that it's all done by the Bolsheviks. So we have this whole conspiracy theory thing going on. It's 1932, that the Bolsheviks have somehow infiltrated British society and are creating mayhem for the hunters. And so she goes on to say that this friend of hers was saying, and she thinks she's right, that the Bolsheviks are out to do anything they can which will stop hunting. They know quite well, the devils, that every kind of sport, and especially hunting, does more to put down socialism than all the speeches in the world. So, as they can't do very much with the RSVP nonsense, they go about spreading foot and mouth germs all over the countryside. Again, you know, some things are just timeless, right? So we have a little conspiracy theory going on there. And then we also have, you know, the name of the book is Christmas Pudding. So where does the name of the book come from? And it comes from this idea that Lady Bobbin has about Christmas. And so Mitford tells us that she kind of combines traditions. And so she says, thus the Christmas tree, Christmas stockings, and other activities of Santa Claus, and the exchange through the post of endless cards and calendars, that's German, the mistletoe and holly decorations, the turkeys, the boar's head, and a succession of carol singers and mummers, that's the Sussex Roman Catholic, and the unlimited opportunity to overeat on every sort of unwholesome food washed down with honest beer, which forms the groundwork for both schools of thought combined to provide the ingredients of Lady Bobbin's Christmas pudding. Mm-hmm.
That was fun to come across that, to find out why it was named Christmas pudding.
Because, I mean, we're not spending a lot of time on Christmas, mm-mm, necessarily. It's just kind, mm-mm, of like that's what time it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think it almost allures to the mix of people that are there.
I was just thinking that.
Yes.
Yeah.
You've got this big Christmas mishmash of country folk and city folk and romances, and it's just funny.
Yep.
Silly stuff.
Yeah.
One of the other guests that's at her house is Duchess of St. Neots, and I just, again, kind of those oddball observations that Mitford makes that I think are kind of timeless. And so the Duchess is making these comments about how they kind of live too grandly. Everybody lives too grandly. And what would happen if they all had to kind of live more simply or minimalistic? And so she and Lady Bobbin are having a conversation about, you know, what that would look like. And so Lady Bobbin says, I wonder, Louisa, whether you will be quite so glad to the end of capitalism when you find yourself without the common necessities of life. And the Duchess says, I don't anticipate that. The world at present is suffering from overproduction, not underproduction of the necessities of life. And I thought, you know, I guess I went to, you know, see that for 1932. But, you know, again, for their class, that would have been, they had plenty of everything.
Right.
So several other characters. Anybody else want to? Sally and Walter, any comments about them?
Oh, I love them. I think they were great. There's a point where Philadelphia and Paul have sought out Amabel for her advice on what to do regarding them eloping or getting married or turning down Michael's engagement. And Philadelphia argues, look how poor Walter and Sally are. They couldn't be worse off, but they are the two happiest people I've ever met, in her argument for marrying for love. And Amabel responds in her very matter-of-fact way, Walter and Sally are very exceptional. I am inclined even to think that they are unique. However, I have personally never come across another case like theirs in my life. Nothing that could happen would ever make the smallest difference to their feeling for each other. I suppose a love of that sort can be found once in a generation. So I think that speaks a lot to what they were like as a couple, because in just various little tidbits that we see them in the story is they have this new baby, and they, you know, they're just not sure what to name it. And Paul just throws out a name, and they look at her and say, okay, that's your name. And Sally, you know, just, they ask Sally how being a new mother is. And she says, oh, it's all right, but the money you can make off it is great, now that I can finally get 10 pence for writing a mother's column in the paper. Or something else happens, and she asks, oh, Philadelphia tells Sally that she wants to elope with Paul. And Sally says, well, if you do, sell me your story, and I can write it for a good amount of money. So they're always just kind of hokily looking for the next dime. But they're very honest about it, I think, is what's charming.
I agree. They're really fun characters. And I hadn't thought about them in that way, about they're not greedy. It's
right.
Just sort of this, there's a pure innocence about them, even though they're, it's just like, because they don't have other income, they don't have a lot of income. They are poor, right? And I think so, because that goes along with Mitford's feeling that you can't have both. You can't have great love and money. You have one or the other. And Walter and Sally are very happy. They love each other, and they don't have a lot.
Yeah. And I think there are some of these bright young things. And if you've read Welty or Fitzgerald, it's that same thing. There's always, there seems to be those characters that just move from wealthy home to wealthy home, and they're very entertaining. People enjoy their company. And so that's the trade-off, that you have these poor people in your home, and they're fun and vivacious and enjoyable company. And in return, you know, you feed them and you house them, and they just move on from, you know, wealthy home to wealthy home, and that's how they make their way in the world.
Right.
Another interesting character is Paul's girlfriend before he falls in love, or believes he falls in love with Philadelphia, Marcella Brackett. And I like the quote that described her. She belonged to that rare and objectionable species, the intellectual snob devoid of intellect.
So she's trying to make her way in the world just very differently.
Okay, well, we have a caller. Hello, this is Judy. You're on the air. Who's this?
Oops, on the wrong number.
Well, darn it.
Bye.
Well, that was fun. That was such a Nancy Mitford thing. We should have invited her to stay. So, we were talking about Marcella. And this is kind of a doomed love affair, too, because nobody likes her. Whenever he brings her up, people say the meanest things about her. Mm-hmm. And really, she's just using him as a springboard to find, you know, I guess her wealthy love, because Paul does not have money. So another thing that Mitford refers to is that how Paul feels about her, that he knew that his affair with her would not come to any satisfactory conclusion, for although he loved her, he knew that he would always dislike her. So, any other characters you want to talk about? we covered the main ones, but, you know, like we said, that the first or the second line of the book is 16 characters in search of an author. So they're all delightful. Just
they
the intermingling of these characters, delightful. And just to end, you know, our discussion about Christmas pudding, the review I looked at, Cook writes, good Christmas novels, tinsely but unmawkish, are hard to find. Christmas pudding, though, fits the bill perfectly. Unlike visiting relatives, it will never outstay its welcome. Swig it down quickly so the bubbles go straight to your head. So, okay, so to remind people, you're listening to Radio Book Club on 89.5. Please call us at 745-8900 and share your thoughts, or even as a wrong number, I guess. So let's talk about the second novel that's in this volume, and that is Pigeon Pie. Okay. Helen Zaltzman is a reviewer of books, and she wrote in The Guardian, this novel opens with the declaration of the Second World War, but Mitford completed it by Christmas 1939. Her frivolous confection was not intended to mock the conflict itself, which was a less welcome object of satire by the time of publication in May 1940. Indeed, from its outset, the war devastated the Mitford family. On its first day, Nancy's Hitler-besotted sister, Unity, shot herself in the head. By contrast, the novel's aristocratic heroine, Sophia, continues largely as before in a whirl of pink champagne and nightclubs, even though she is obliged to spend the days volunteering at a first aid post, as Nancy herself did. Sophia and her Hitler-admiring husband enjoy an open relationship in contrast to Mitford's marriage, which foundered the same year amid infidelity on both sides. So what did you two think about the use of comedy for this time period, just the onset of World War II?
I mean, I think it just goes back to Mitford just being that paradoxically humorous, I think. And even, I guess, pointing out, too, that she had a sister who was, I guess, in love with Hitler, so to say, and shot herself. And so she goes on to write a book where her main character forges on and ignores the war and drinks champagne, which is, I think, is kind of a, I don't want to say self-prophetizing kind of thing, but, you know, if you're sad and you write a story where, I guess, you put yourself in the character who goes on,
mm-hmm. that grandly, survives.
Yeah, that grandly, then that's kind of what you're looking for. So I think that's kind of where the book came from. As far as war commentary, I guess.
Yeah. Melissa? No?
No comment. No comment right now.
And I was thinking that I taught a class at the college. And it was Psychology of Humor. And one of the texts I look at was Humor in Hitler's Germany. And so we sometimes think that, you know, the world must be such a dark place that there is no humor. But any of the Holocaust writings that you look at, you may find some elements of humor there. And so even in Hitler's Germany, there was many comedians. Oftentimes it was Jewish comedians, and they would initially, you know, be trying to maintain some humor about this. It's kind of a survival technique. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you know, they would eventually be squelched and you know, horrible things would happen to them. But that was one of the things they did as a survival tool. Mm-hmm. So, but, yeah, it talks about that in the prologue, that the timing for this was probably not the best.
Right.
Yeah. So you mentioned earlier, Melissa, the Boston Brotherhood, or you were thinking about some religious group that came to the house. So that was, you were thinking about in Pigeon Pie. So I don't know if you want to mention that Sophia and her husband it's really Sophia's husband who has this inclination to take on.
Right. He becomes a member first. And I think I remember him saying, though, that I think he had this vision of sort of becoming the grand leader of it. And I think the Mitford did the same thing here just by making up Boston Brotherhood. I think I Googled it and didn't find anything.
Well, she does say that, you know, after some years of marriage, Luke had joined the Boston Brotherhood, one of those new religions which are wafted to us every 6 months or so across the Atlantic. So she does a lot of poking of fun at Americans.
She does.
Especially in this book. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's just one of them. So as the book begins and England is just starting to get involved in the conflict. Sophia's on a train, and of course, this idea that everyone kind of needs to contribute and what's happening now in their world is being talked about. So she gets convinced that she needs to go sign up at the post, and so she says she goes over. She had to wait in a queue before being interviewed by a lady at a desk. The young man in front of her announced that he was a Czech and not afraid of bombs. The lady said, "Nor are British women afraid of bombs," which Sophia thought was going too far.
Yes.
And again, you know, just those little comments. And it's just so funny. So when Mitford is talking about, well, you know, they really need to get the war started. And so I don't know if you recall this section, but it's kind of long, but I'm going to read it because, again, it's just so funny. Rather soon after the war had been declared, it became obvious that nobody intended it to begin. The belligerent countries were behaving like children in a round game, picking up sides, and until the sides had been picked up, the game could not start. England picked up France. Germany picked up Italy. England beckoned to Poland. Germany answered with Russia. Then Italy's nanny said she had fallen down and grazed her knee running and mustn't play. England picked up Turkey. Germany picked up Spain, but Spain's nanny said she had internal troubles and must sit this one out. England looked towards the Oslo group, but they had never played before except little Belgium, who had hated it, and the others felt shy. America, of course, was too much of a baby for such a grown-up game, but she was just longing to see it played, and still it would not begin. Yeah, I mean, we're just speechless. All the things that you read about, you know, what was going on in the world before World War II, you know, you never quite picture it as a children's game picking up sides.
Exactly.
Yeah, we're choosing up sides.
Exactly.
America was too big a baby.
I think that's another good example of Mitford's writing style and kind of her genius, her ability to take these sort of dark truths and write about them with this thread of humor.
And a fresh eye.
Right.
Yeah, really looking at something in a very different way. So one of the things that, of course, this is wartime now, and again, if you think about this era, people would gather around the wireless, around the radio, because that was an important part of their life. People were looking for news about what was happening in the conflict or in the war. And so the character Sophia hated the wireless. It seemed to her to be a definite and living force for evil in the land. When she turned it on, she thought of the women all over England in lonely houses with their husbands gone to the war, sick with anxiety for the future. She saw them putting their children to bed, their hearts broken by the loneliness of the evening hours, and then, for company, turning on the wireless. What is the inspiration which flows to them from this, the fountainhead, as it must seem to them, of the empire? London, with all its resources of genius, talent, wit. How does London help them through these difficult times? How are they made to feel that England is not only worth dying for, but being poor for, being lonely and unhappy for? With great music, stirring words, and sound common sense? With the glorious literature nobly spoken of our ancestors? Not at all. With facetiousness and jazz. And I think that was probably the saddest or... with facetiousness and jazz, I mean, there's some sarcasm there, but it's just not her, you know, usual biting kind of commentary.
Right.
So, yeah, she probably nailed it, though, for its accuracy.
I wonder then if she, in her commentary on the war, she was more able to poke fun at it in the choosing sides kind of thing as a child's game. And then, but really... where she does care is in the women that have to listen to it on the other end of the radio, I think.
So but she's acknowledging that human
aspect. She's acknowledging
aspect.
It, but she can't quite make fun of it in the same way,
mm-hmm.
because she cares more about it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, those are people, yeah, that if you think about it are victims. I mean, they're not really choosing that for themselves, that this is something the country has decided and their men go off to war, and so now they are left at home. Trying to hold it together, and what does the country offer them?
Mm-hmm.
Jazz music. Yeah. So, one of the characters in the book is Olga, and Olga's kind of an interesting character. everybody's getting a job because it's the war. And so Sophia has gone to the post to help, but she's got a thing with knees. So she can't do anything medical because if there's some knees involved, she
has to see a knee.
No, yes. She doesn't even want to see a knee. Yes. So she's left on the other side of the curtain. So she handles things like correspondence and the phone call and, you know, arranging things, but she doesn't want to see knees. Again, what? So her friend Olga also has taken on a job. And to be outdone, not to be outdone, Olga has decided her job is
to be a spy.
Yes, Olga is a spy. And the other interesting thing about Olga is Olga's actually a British citizen, but because she marries a Russian, she has developed a Russian accent. And now she refers to her mother as a mushka, or, you know, instead of mama, as she had before. And so she just really takes on these characterizations, I would imagine.
Right. And even though Sophia has known her all her life, I think,
mm-hmm.
right, all of a sudden Olga is speaking with Russian accent and just made up this history for
yes.
herself.
So now she's a spy. And I guess what I love is that, you know, she's not – she wouldn't be a very good spy because, of course, she has to tell everybody, you know, oh, I'm waiting for my chief to call and I'm going to go. And she's seen in obvious places wearing these elaborate kind of costumes. So she appears what she would, in her mind, believe a spy would look like. And so Sophia then, just to play along, says, I'm getting tired of Olga in the role of beautiful female spy. It's becoming a bore. I've sent her a telegram saying, proceed, John O'Groats, and await further instructions, F-69. So she sends her this missive, you know, so some kind of secret mission that Olga's supposed to go on. But again, how fun.
Yep.
One of the other kinds of funny things, and you know, I didn't look up if this was actually true, if England did this, but one of the characters in the book is the Song King. And this is part of the plot, too, where the belief is that England is going to use the Song King to, as part of their program, to inspire the British people to, you know, get behind the war effort. And actually, what's happened is he's been kidnapped by Germans, and they're using him instead as kind of a symbol of a British person who has forsaken the motherland and recognizes Germany as the true place to, or the place of righteousness. And so now he's performing on behalf of the Germans, and now he's the Liederkönig, the Song King. But one of the programs that he does is pets programs. So, you know, as a pet owner, did you think perhaps the animals you've had would enjoy having a radio show that specifically?
I can't say that really struck me as likely. But who knows? They do have television programs now where they say that pets just sit and watch. So I don't know.
Who knows? But again, so from Mitford's point of view, she says the pets programs, were a terrible thorn in the side of the authorities, who considered that all the other pieces in his repertoire were exceedingly harmless, although the news which was thrown in at the end always included some item proving that the German Secret Service arrangements for transmitting facts to Berlin had ours beat by about 12 hours. And this certainly did tease the MI, rather. But the pets program were a definite menace. Playing upon the well-known English love of animals, the wily Hun provided the enormous treat for the pets of the United Kingdom. So, you know, I don't know if Mitford is painting a picture for us where the animals would create an uprising, maybe an animal farm kind of thing, and so swaying the British folks towards the German way of thinking. So, again, the reviewer who talks about Pigeon Pie, she wrote, bored, without a sniff of war action, Sophia sets about unraveling the German spy network that appears to be operating out of her house in London. She's the ideal instrument for a knotty scheme of espionage and counter-espionage, being credulous and none too bright, while any peculiar behavior is unremarkable to her because the novel is populated by self-absorbed eccentrics. And again, I could just picture this as a movie because this is just kind of that character where she's bumbling, but somehow, even though she's bumbling, she does the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I don't know if when you were reading it, did you ever feel like, oh, you know, like when I think it's Weatherly wants to send her over to the post to write down everything that's on the board and find out who's on staff, and it's just a fool's mission. Mm-hmm. But I bought into it. So when Sophie's thinking, oh, you know, really, she just wants to go up and be in her bed and read her book. And so she's trying to think up a reason why or you know, what the answer to his questions would be without actually having to go do it. And so then it turns out to have been absolutely the right thing to do, because when she just pretends to leave and then sneaks around back in through a side door, she overhears this conversation, and then she kind of reveals this counter-espionage thing that's going on and how she's been, you know, set up to do these errands that are not necessary at all.
Very clever.
Yes. Yep. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to quit second-guessing Sophia. When she doesn't follow through on something, I'm just going to believe that it's the right thing to do. Because all is well in the end, right?
That's right.
But like going back to Saltzman's review of Sophia as an ideal instrument for this scheme, she's credulous and not too bright. Peculiar behavior is unremarkable because it's self-absorbed by, or it's populated by self-absorbed eccentrics. Much of the buildup in the beginning of Pigeon Pie about talking about Sophia is she's married to this businessman in London, and he's trying to come up in the business, so he needs to be hosting parties and hosting the uprights of society, and so she's left to do all this hosting, and she's so bored of it. She doesn't think she has anything to talk about. She doesn't think she gets along with these people. She's so bored of it. And so then by kind of becoming a spy or becoming, you know, aware of this counter-espionage, she's more enthralled, I think, in having fun and games, I would say.
So just some of the other looking at Mitford as an author, I think we talked about, she does mix romance with laughter. And I guess that's, you know, in my mind where I think about some of those old romantic comedies from the 30s and 40s. And her really astute observations about the world.
Mm-hmm.
And you had one really fun quote about, I think, I'm going to say that, and then it's like, where was that?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I had made note of that. And now I'm not remembering where it is. Maybe I'll come across it.
Okay. Her neat character drawing, I mean, that's kind of been the focus. We've included some discussion about the plot, of course, which is just the vehicle for these characters to be in. But they're so distinct. The first book, Christmas Pudding, there's so many, and some of them are minor characters. But even those, if you look at them or talk about them, they're very distinctly drawn and have some very funny kinds of aspects to them. Just some of her daring opinions, that she reflected things, as we talked about some of the humor for a World War II kinds of book. You know, she talked about class and the wealthy and even, you know, included some things about fashion. Jane Smiley said in the foreword, Mitford is skeptical about the traditional happy ending that brings love and money together. So we talked about that, that you can't have both. And Bright Young Things, that these were novels of the time. The only thing we didn't talk about is there's quite a few journal entries in there of the dead Bob and ancestor. And I guess I was thinking a little bit about that. And it was almost, again, that juxtaposition, because here's Paul all excited about writing this story, and it seemed like the most boring journal ever. Yeah, you know, this woman who was, you know, had this happy life and had all these children and everything goes, you know, fairly well. So it was not going to be the kind of novel that Mitford, or book that Mitford would write. So any parting comments about our Mitford books?
Just, I'm really glad you chose it. It's not a book I would have likely picked up on my own, but I would definitely read more by Nancy Mitford.
Definitely, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's nice to hear, like we pointed out, Dylan's the young person on the panel today. So, you know, that she has an appeal across generations and across the years, right? Mm-hmm. So I want to thank Melissa and Dylan for joining me today as we talked about Christmas Pudding and Pigeon Pie, two of Nancy Mitford's delightful British novels. Next month, we will be discussing To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee. And I'm excited to have two English teachers join me. Debbie Bohm is retired from Palmer High School, and Jason Marvel from Wasilla High School. So that'll be great fun. They're actually hopefully going to lead the discussion because they're very knowledgeable. And we're going to be talking about why this is still a relevant book for high school students to read.
Great.
I also want to remind listeners that 89.5 is a community radio station that relies on support from listeners like you. So please take the time to visit our website, radiofreepalmer.org, and become a contributing member. This is Judy Getty with Radio Book Club. Happy reading.